In the United States, public policy discussions often come down to trying to find a balance between advocating for what is good for society as a whole and the rights of individuals. Add in industries that have a lot to lose with regulation, and it becomes even harder to reach consensus.
Guns and tobacco are two examples of those debates that happen with strong feelings and interests on all sides. But tackling the impact of the food and beverage industry isn't far behind. Whether it's banning trans fats or limiting how big a soda can be, do these efforts go too far? And limiting personal choice in the pursuit of public health.
Joining us to discuss the efforts to educate the public about the harm associated with soft drink consumption and why the tide may be turning is Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics: Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Marion, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, glad to be there.
So, Marion, how big is the soft drink industry in the United States?
Oh, it's absolutely enormous. It's dominated by Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. Those are the big ones, with Dr. Pepper Snapple running a third. And they bring in billions of dollars a year in profits, and they sell billions of sodas a year, every day, actually. The amount of soda that's sold is staggering. Americans consume about 30 gallons a year per capita, and half the population doesn't drink them. So that means everybody else is drinking a lot more.
So you said an average of 30 gallons of soda per
person.
Well,
it's actually about 1 12-ounce can, somewhere between 10 and 12 ounces a day per person. And that's per capita, men, women, and little tiny babies. And if half the population doesn't drink that much every day, that means the other half is drinking twice as much. So average consumption for the people who do drink sodas is 2 a day, 24 ounces a day, roughly.
So has that changed at all over the last few decades?
Well, if you can believe it, it's gone down. One of the remarkable trends in American diets is that soda consumption, which started going up dramatically in the early 1980s and reached a peak in the late 1990s, has been falling ever since and has gone down by 20 to 25%, something that the soda industry attributes to health advocacy.
So how does that compare to soda consumption in other countries?
Well, it depends on which country. Mexico has a per capita consumption that's somewhere equivalent to ours, and so does Argentina. But countries like India and China drink practically none. And so those are the target markets for soda marketing these days.
And we'll certainly talk more about marketing, but let's go back to that figure. You said that the per capita average is 30 gallons a day, but you said about half of the people don't drink any soda at all.
No, it's 30 gallons a year.
Oh, you're right.
Yes,
a day would
be really horrifying, wouldn't it? Yeah, 10 to 12 ounces a day.
So who is it? You said half of the population is not drinking any at all. Who is drinking all that soda?
Well, the soda industry can lay that out very clearly, and the people who drink the most soda tend to be young men, people who do not have much education, who don't have much money, who have blue-collar jobs, less than a high school education. The lower the socioeconomic status, the more sodas are consumed. And it's not an accident that that's where so much of the targeted marketing goes.
And is there a racial component to that as well?
Yeah, low-income minorities drink the most soda. And the targeted marketing goes to low-income African-Americans and Hispanics.
We're talking with Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics: Taking on Big Soda and Winning. Now, Marion, what are some of the health concerns that are related to drinking soda?
Well, the big one is the amount of sugar that they contain. From a public health standpoint, sodas are what we call low-hanging fruit. They're an easy target because they contain sugars, water, flavors, but have no redeeming nutritional value. High diets that are high in sugar are associated with weight gain, obesity, poor diets in general, heart disease, type 2 diabetes is the big one. And there are studies that show that soda consumption is independently associated with those conditions, but there's even more suggestion that soda consumption is correlated with obesity, which is correlated with those conditions. Obviously, people who drink sodas eat other foods, so it's very hard to attribute whatever the problems are to just that one food.
And do we have a sense of what kind of financial costs there are that come with those soda-related health issues?
Well, obesity alone is hundreds of billions of dollars a year. I've seen estimates ranging from 200 to 800 billion, depending on how they count that. But that counts for healthcare costs and lost productivity. And there have been estimates of the contribution of soda to those costs, but I'm not sure I take them very seriously. They're based on a lot of estimations. The numbers are big.
Now, certainly we've heard a lot about artificial sweeteners in the past years, whether they're safe or in what quantities, but you're really focusing on the sugar soft drinks. Why is that?
Well, it has calories, and the artificial sweeteners don't, and people drink much, much more sugar-sweetened beverage than they do of the diet sodas. Diet sodas in the United States are maybe a third, less than a third, of total soda of carbonated beverage consumption. And it's interesting about diet sodas that there's very little evidence that they help people maintain or control weight. People who drink diet sodas seem to make up for the missing calories by eating calories from other sources. And in fact, one of the big disappointments this week is that the CDC has just come out with new data on obesity prevalence. And it shows that the prevalence of obesity in the United States is going up a little bit. And that's very disappointing because both sodas and sugar consumption has been on a decline for the last 10 years. And you would hope that that would show up in some kind of leveling off of obesity rates. They have leveled off in children, but not in adults.
So there's little doubt that Americans get a lot of extra calories in their diets from a range of different products. But you write about the calories in soda that create particular problems. What is it about those calories that are in soda that are so problematic in the human body?
Well, it's the sugars. And it's what's fascinating to me is the amount of sugar in sodas. I just can't get my head around it. There's roughly a teaspoon of sugar in sugars, plural, because most of it is high fructose corn syrup, but of sugars in every ounce of soda. It's actually 5/6 of an ounce. 5/6 of a teaspoon per ounce, but let's call it, we'll round it up and call it a teaspoon. That means if you have a 12-ounce soda, you've got 10 to 12 teaspoons. If you've got a 20-ounce soda, you've got 16 or 18 teaspoons of sugars in there. That's a lot to take in at any one time. If you were sitting there with a glass of water putting cubes or packets of sugar in, it would be like taking a glucose tolerance test. And the body's not equipped to handle that amount of sugar absorbed through the intestine that quickly. It just does all kinds of things to hormonal balances and our ability to handle the calories that we're consuming. It's much healthier to eat sugars in the form of solid food than it is in liquid food, it appears, just simply because of how quickly it gets absorbed.
Certainly in the public health campaigns around smoking, there's been a strong recognition of the addictive qualities of cigarettes. Is there any proof that soda is addictive?
Well, there's certainly suggestions. Proof is too strong, I think. There are people who feel that they're addicted to sodas. There are people who feel that they're addicted to diet sodas. And they exhibit many of the same symptoms that people who are addicted to more harmful things exhibit. They crave the substance. They feel deprived of it when they don't have it. They will do anything that they possibly can in order to get it. It's sugars affect the same pleasure centers as do psychoactive drugs and cigarettes and those kinds of things, although not nearly to the same extent. And so I think the addiction issue is being argued, and I don't think it's settled, but there certainly are suggestions in that direction.
So another similarity to tobacco control efforts is your examination of marketing done on behalf of the soda industry. An interview with you by the Center for Science and the Public Interest claimed that soda sells happiness and other emotions as opposed to the product itself. Why would you say that?
Well, I just came back from a trip to Coca-Cola World in Atlanta, and the visit there, which you have to pay $16 to get into, starts out with a video that had everybody in tears. Even I was sort of trickling because it's so absolutely touching. What Coca-Cola sells is love, happiness, and great moments in people's lives, many of which are deeply touching, and you're to celebrate them with sodas. You don't think about the health effects or anything else connected with that. So I ended up thinking that Coca-Cola is a schizophrenic company. On the one hand, you have its public face, which is selling love, happiness, and wonderful moments. And on the other hand, you have the behind-the-scenes people who are making every one of those decisions very strategically in order to get people to have brand loyalty and to want to drink more of the product and to think it's normal and wonderful to drink it all day long.
We're talking with Marion Nessel about her latest book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And we want to hear from you. Do you support efforts to regulate the food and beverage industry more closely with the hopes of improving public health? Does soda consumption concern you personally? If you're a parent, do you worry about how much soda your child drinks? Join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now with Marion Nessel about her latest book. It's called Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And we want to hear from you on this. Where do you think the balance is between individual freedom and public health? Would you support having the beverage industry more closely regulated? And if you would, what would you like to see put in place? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Marion, there are many people who feel strongly that adults should be able to buy whatever food and beverages they want to in whatever quantities they want. How do you respond to those concerns about limiting soft drinks?
Well, I think the government is already deeply involved in food choices, and we currently have a food environment that promotes certain kinds of diets and makes certain foods cheaper than others, and in many, many ways makes it possible for people to eat one way rather than another without any concern about health at all. Health is something that we all share in equally. If our healthcare system is overwhelmed by people who have type 2 diabetes, which is just an awful disease for individuals, but it's also an awful disease for society because the healthcare costs are so great. We live in a society in which we all need to help each other with these things. And as it turns out, if measures against sodas, like the Berkeley soda tax, for example, was clearly tied to using the revenues for purposes that everybody could get behind, in this case, child health initiatives, it sailed through, and both conservative and liberal people voted for it. I think there's real bipartisan support for trying to do social programs that will help everybody.
Yet, on the other hand, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg really brought this issue into the public eye when he tried to limit the size of soft drinks that could be sold in his city, and that did not go nearly as well.
No, and I think it didn't go well because I live in New York City, so I got to watch this in action. The proposal violated basic rules of food advocacy. If you're going to do food advocacy, the first thing you have to do is to have allies. And no attempt whatsoever was made to recruit allies in advance of the announcement so that it came as kind of a surprise to everybody and nobody had much time to think about it. The Bloomberg administration was shocked that the African American and Hispanic communities supported the soda industry in its fight against the soda cap. And yet when people talk to people in those communities later, they say, well, nobody ever came to talk to us about it. And that's violating rule number one. You can't expect to just dump these things and have everybody get behind them. You need to do a lot of work to explain what this is about, especially in a situation where the burden of type 2 diabetes and the diseases that go with soda consumption are borne more by the African American and Hispanic communities than they are by the white communities.
So, Marion, the title of your book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. You did say that soda consumption has gone down since the peak in the late 1990s. Who is it in that title of your book that is taking on Big Soda?
Well, there are an enormous numbers of advocacy organizations that are using sodas as an example of where you can use public policy to create healthier food environments. I can't even count the number of groups, the number of cities, the number of statewide initiatives, the number of public health campaigns that are using this as the first line of something that you can do for your health that really isn't very difficult to do. So there are lots and lots of substitute water campaigns, of drink water, not soda, of attempts to remove sodas from schools, remove sodas from workplaces, and just try to create an environment where there are healthy, where there are healthier beverages around. And many of these are quite successful.
A caller, Jeremy, who couldn't stand the line, actually did say, we don't need the government to get involved with soda regulation. Kids are learning about sugary soda in schools. Jeremy said that his 7-year-old told him that he'd never have a soda because it's bad for you. So it sounds like there are some strong educational efforts. Is that enough, or does it need to go along with regulation?
Well, I think both will help. I mean, not every school is doing that. That's really wonderful. Somebody is really taking that on. So that's what I meant by an example of a school district that is dealing with the issue and trying to get children more interested in drinking healthier beverages. And if they can set up that habit, that's going to be a lifetime habit. Now, sodas aren't poison. Nobody's concerned about having a small one once in a while as a treat. It's drinking them as a replacement for water that's such a big concern, again, because of the extraordinary amount of sugar that they contain. So, yes, education works in some situations, but it works better if it's accompanied by policies, because policies make it easier for people to make those kinds of choices.
We're talking with Marion Nessel about her latest book, Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning. And let's go to the phones and Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Great program. First, my confession. I have been a Coca-holic for 40 years. And I'll partially point the finger of blame at my parents, who would never, ever allow soda in the house. So the moment I left for college, there was suddenly Coca-Cola, the nice big 16-ounce bottle in my room. And I've always found ways to justify drinking plenty of Coca-Cola. Now I'm at the age where I have a heart condition and things, and I know I shouldn't be drinking it because of the soda or the sugar and the caffeine. What do you recommend as some good possible options for trying to get off this?
Thanks for that. Why don't you try the 7.5-ounce cans and try to limit yourself to one of them and just cut down less frequently and in smaller portions would be my advice if it's something that you just don't feel that you can give up. And you need to make sure that the rest of your diet is healthy.
Thanks for that call, Dave.
Well, good luck with it.
Yeah, it's probably, like any habit, it's not easy to change. Marion, in just the minute or so we have left, what does success look like in this battle? Is it different labeling? Is it restrictions, limits on size? What will you define as success?
Well, I would define it as not thinking that drinking sodas all day long is normal, especially for children. to make sugar sweetened beverages treats, once in a while treats, not everyday fare, and to look at these drinks as liquid candy. And, you know, you wouldn't feed candy to kids all day long, and I don't think sodas should be fed to kids all day long either. Again, not removing them completely, but giving them a very different place in the diet, something similar to where the place that candy has. And the soda industry is well aware of all of this, and they are making healthier beverages. They're promoting the use of these small cans and doing other things that I think will help people with that.
Marion, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Marion Nessel. She's a professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and a professor of sociology at New York University. Her most recent book is Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning.